If you say, I was watching this film and in it was that guy, you know, Band of Snoop Cucumber. And everyone knows exactly who you mean. This is Bad Voltage. This is episode 33 of season 2. Should be being put out on Thursday the 14th of June 2018, assuming Jono pulls his finger out this time.
Should? You're not sounding confident here.
Well, I was gonna say, you know.
Also, what about, why am I pulling my finger out?
We are now back. We skipped show because Jono was on holiday.
I was, and it was great. Wow. It was fantastic. Go to the Dominican Republic, everyone, if you can go over there. It's brilliant. Fantastic country. Great food.
Where is the Dominican Republic?
It's...
I got on a plane in San Francisco and got off somewhere else.
That's how I tend to think about it. It's like off the east coast of the US. It's kind of like where the Caribbean is, that kind of area.
Oh, right. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and it's brilliant. It's, well recommended. The weather was fantastic, so... But, you know, good to be back with you guys.
And on that note...
almost with a straight face. And now, Bad Voltage.
Should we do some news for the entire show?
Well, part of the advantage with having skipped a show is it's now been a month. So there's... Tons of stuff which has happened.
Yeah, there's
honestly,
a lot of stuff.
Loads and loads and loads. Jono, why don't you start us off?
Shall I get us going?
Sure.
All right. Well, first of all, I want to make, I want to dedicate this show to two people. One person who we know, one person who we don't know. So Anthony Bourdain sadly died recently, and he was one of the coolest people on the planet. So
he was.
To him. And Rob Limo, who was... you know, in the early days of open source, he passed away recently as well. So hope those guys are doing well, wherever they may or may not be. Anyway, I think we should start with a big piece of news recently. Microsoft bought GitHub.
Really? Wow, I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, you hadn't picked up on this?
Yeah. It's only been the sole topic of conversation for the last week, honestly.
You know, it's not like OpenSUSE acquires SourceForge. So the sale was for $7.5 billion, if I remember correctly. And this had been going on for a little, like there's been some discussions and negotiations for a little while. They finally settled on this. What do you guys think about this? I mean, Microsoft are to this day a divisive company for a lot of open source people, particularly people who've been around open source for a long time.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting because realistically, GitHub as a organization that raised over $350 million in VC, right? They really only had three options. Acquisition, which is obviously what happened, and IPO are going bust. And that puts them in a little bit of a weird situation, right? Once you've raised that much money, just being a business really is off the table as an option for better or for worse. So,
yeah, this is a tragic thing about the way we've decided... as a world to organize ourselves, that if you raise that much money, you can't then run a business where you sell things to people and earn enough money to cover all your costs and make a bit of profit. You have to. That kind of, you know, be a standard business, as you say, it's just not on the table anymore.
And if you raise 350 because of the returns that a VC is going to want, it really limits the number of companies that can realistically acquire you, right?
On the grounds, if you're looking for 10 to 1 or 100 to 1 returns on your investment, then you've got to be selling someone who's got $3 billion in the first place. Which is Bad Voltage, Microsoft, who else?
It's interesting. I can't remember if we talked about this on the show. I know Erica and I were chatting about this one night, and I think I might have said this on the show, but we were talking about like who would acquire GitHub. And the only company we could come up with was Microsoft for two reasons. One is they're one of the few companies that's going to have enough money to buy GitHub, because GitHub is going to be multiple billions. It's actually $7.5 billion was more than I was expecting, but you know, it wasn't going to be far off that. But the second reason is GitHub cared deeply about you know, there's so much culture at GitHub around, you know, the modern software developer and, you know, and all the rest of it, that they would only want to sell to a company that is going to understand that and be able to further that. So who are those companies who've got enough money who really kind of get developers? It's not going to be Oracle. They'd be big enough. It could conceivably be Google.
And there was rumors that there was some discussions with Google during the acquisition process.
So we came to the conclusion that Microsoft was the most logical place because they've been doing a lot in the open source recently. So, you know.
I think another potential one would have maybe been Amazon as they're building out AWS as a platform and trying to get more developers on that platform. That could have been one vehicle. Obviously, an organization with enough money, certainly.
Yeah,
could be. But they, in my head, and this is maybe not an accurate reflection, but Amazon aren't really interested in building developer things. They're interested in building things that developers use. It's a fine line, maybe, but
no, I would agree. It would have been a little bit of a pivot for them. I just was thinking of organizations large enough that are developer focused. So it's interesting. Right. A lot of people think that Microsoft was the right acquisition partner here, and clearly, a lot of people don't think that. So to put it nicely,
what do you guys think? Like, do you think it's a good home for GitHub? I'm putting the acquisition to one side, like them being the, you know, the arbiter of the future GitHub. What do you think?
So I think for a lot of people, it's a little sad to see GitHub not remain a neutral player, right? So I don't know that, while the people that who are disappointed would maybe be slightly different if it was Google or slightly different if it was Amazon, I think there's a little bit of reticence to have what's Microsoft, I would say, is not considered a neutral player in this, to now own GitHub. I think one of the interesting things here is all of the realization of how, in my opinion, short-sighted the reliance on GitHub was. So to all you Go programmers who are importing unvendored, unversioned GitHub URLs into your code, this might be the wake-up call that should have happened years ago. But so to those specific people complaining, I don't get the complaint. You should have never been doing what you're doing anyway. So that it's Microsoft now, to me, makes no difference. It just was a bad practice. But I think that it's an interesting home in that I think the real value for Microsoft is not going to be in the revenue that GitHub generates, right? Because it's not really going to be enough, I wouldn't think, to recoup their money in a reasonable time. But in the relationships that it builds as they're trying to get some mindshare back with developers.
Absolutely.
So I don't know of any other home that would have targeted that little bit more fuzzy, little bit less revenue-driven idea.
From a
comp perspective, the only reasonable comparison I can think to GitHub, and this would be a company that isn't what GitHub's doing, but I think what GitHub wanted to do would maybe be Atlassian, and they're worth about $15 billion, so about double the acquisition cost. I can't think of another reasonable comp. I don't know if either of you two can.
No.
I mean, there's
GitLab, but they're I think.
Yeah, but people
are different.
Yeah, but people aren't buying GitHub. People weren't looking to buy GitHub. Microsoft did not buy GitHub because their technology is so much better than the competition.
Right. Oh no! Like
they're buying mindshare. They're buying a central pivot point around which a large portion of the open source world, the technology world as a whole, from the development side, it all rotates around GitHub, which is either brilliant marketing by them or essentially an accident of history, however you look at it. But that's what Microsoft are buying, right? If you bought GitLab, you get the same technology. But, I mean, Microsoft had CodePlex already. Google had Google Code already.
Yep.
If they wanted somewhere to be source code hosting, either of those companies can throw thousands of developers at it and easily keep pace with GitHub's level of development. That's not what they're buying. They're buying mindshare.
I was chatting to someone the other day about this, that, you know, the one thing that I think GitHub, the one thing that always blew me away about GitHub is that they know how to build a product. Like, GitHub is a excellent product in terms of what they've done. It's just the UI, the design, the whole thing. It feels very mature. And I find that with a lot of other similar projects, I think GitLab is different. And I think GitLab was a bit more rough around the edges years back. And I think it's really good now. But from day one, GitHub has been a really well-delivered product.
I think I would take an alternative opinion on that. There's a whole bunch of things that it's still mind-boggling that GitHub doesn't do in 2018, in my opinion.
I'm talking about what they do, I think, is really well executed. There's a lot of stuff that it should do that's missing. Like, their project management stuff isn't good, for example. Like, Jira is considerably more flexible than GitHub Issues in every possible way. But I just think that what they've done is they built the mindshare and they delivered a good product, and that's what they're buying. So,
yeah, I mean, we have talked in the past, Jeremy and I, we did a whole show where we spent time talking to Steve Wally, who works at Microsoft and knows his open source onions, right? And we spent that whole show saying, okay, Microsoft are talking a good game about how they now love open source and they want to be partners with developers and it's not the old Microsoft and so on and so forth. How true is this? And Steve was pretty clear, and a whole bunch of other people have been very clear that obviously this is a ship that takes a long time to move, but the willingness really does seem to be there. I don't think it's all a big snow job. And if they can keep this going for a little bit longer, the internal culture will change to the point where if Satya leaves and Satan himself becomes CEO, he'll still find it hard to move the ship back again, which is what we want, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what kind of annoys me where with like a lot of the critics, actually posted a blog post about this yesterday, a lot of the critics were, you know, well, it's almost like, we're not willing to forgive and forget. Like, Microsoft is always going to be the company that it was in, you know, the late 90s, early noughties, and, you know, that they think that Linux is a cancer, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, the company has changed significantly. And it's time that people start to move on.
I think there's some amount of people that there is legitimately nothing Microsoft could do to change your mind.
I have asked that precise question to a couple of people. I said, okay, so they've done a bunch of stuff and that doesn't convince you. Fine. I mean, everyone's got their line. I came over that line pretty recently and I'm only a little bit over it. I still think they've got some stuff to prove, but I'm quietly a believer. But I've said to a couple of people who are going, no, this is a terrible idea. I've said, what could Microsoft have done to this point that would convince you? And they were quite honest and said nothing. And I'm like, well, okay. And you feel like that, no problem. But you can see why no one's particularly interested in your opinion in this argument. If there's literally nothing they can do, then there's no point in even trying to impress you.
That is just outright fucking ignorance. People who have that viewpoint. Just outright ignorance, because everything is changeable.
Interesting sidebar, and I don't want to waste too much time on this discussion, but you said, Ak, you're recently over the line on this. Jono, where do you stand on this one?
With Microsoft buying GitHub?
No, just...
Or just Microsoft in general? Yeah. I think they're heading in the right direction. I think they're doing the right kind of work. You know, I think they... Satya has had a huge impact there, but not just that, you know, I know a lot of people who work at Microsoft and I hear from them that, you know, the company has changed a lot. It's becoming a more interesting place to work. The work that they do, like all these open source projects that they're running, all the work that they've done in other open source projects, I think it's absolutely the right direction. But, you know, I'm mindful of the fact that part of the reason why I think that is because I know a lot of people who work at Microsoft. And I think maybe people who don't know anyone who works at Microsoft might think otherwise, you know?
Right. Okay.
So I hear about it secondhand.
Where are you, Jeremy?
I don't think I'm over the line yet, but I'm approaching the line.
That's the thing. Do you feel like you're more of a believer than you were last week, last month, last year, 10 years ago?
So I guess in the end, I'm a pretty pragmatic guy, and I think they're doing this for pretty pragmatic reasons. I don't think for a second they're doing it because they quote-unquote like open source or love open source or whatever their marketing stuff is. I think that they have... realize that their roots lie in developers, and developers are clearly, clearly entrenched in the open source space, and they're trying to do what they can to get those developers back with a profit motive in mind, and I think that's fine. They have a fiduciary duty to do that. So I think I'm a little less fuzzy about it than some other people, but no, I mean, I think they are legitimately, genuinely interested in open source because they think that that makes the most profit sense to them.
Yeah,
that makes
sense. And I don't view that as a bad thing. I view that as a good thing.
The one final thing I want to chip in on this, and then we should probably move on in a second. But you know, one of the conclusions I came to fairly recently was that I think a lot of the I had a conversation with somebody, and he was basically, you know, this is before the GitHub thing, but the discussion of Microsoft came up, and he basically says, I'll never forgive them. All of this stuff in open source is a sham. And when I dug into it a little bit more, he basically said that the reason why he disapproves of them is because they still ship proprietary software in Windows and various other things. And that's when I came to this conclusion. This was the blog post that I posted, that I think there are some people where software, open source free software, is part of their ethical code. So they see proprietary software as, by definition, an unethical thing. They put it in the same boat as lying, cheating, probably not as bad as things like murder and rape and whatever else.
This is the RMS view of things.
Right, the RMS view of things.
Right, who also think Red Hat and Canonical are too closed. So, I mean, if that's your view, right.
And the thing is that, so from my perspective, I don't believe that proprietary software is unethical. I think it's suboptimal, but I don't believe it's actually unethical. So I think when we see some of the viewpoints here on Microsoft and other companies, like, because their ethical code is different to mine, you know, I might disagree with them, but I'm not going to say they're wrong, because that's their ethical code. They define their ethical code in a different way in which that I define mine. So I think that's one of the reasons why I think some people seem entrenched. It could. I mean, I think people are ignorant if they're unwilling to change their opinion based upon what people do. But I don't think it's ignorant to necessarily ethically oppose something because your ethical code looks different to somebody else's, if you see what I'm saying. And I think that's what's being mixed up in some of this as well. That's the reason why I disagree with a lot with RMS, but he's not necessarily wrong, you know?
True.
So,
I mean, I think one thing that's going to be interesting to watch is what Microsoft ends up doing with GitHub. Not today, but let's say in 2023. Are we going to reach a point where they do then want to recoup some of their investment and they do something like a really heavy integration with Azure or deep CI hooks into Azure, or something where the Azure APIs are baked into a point that other platforms become second-degree citizens, really? I mean, I could maybe see that happening. I think some people are worried that a GitHub account is basically going to be an add-on to Office 365 or something, and there's going to be no standalone GitHub. I genuinely can't see that happening.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen.
I appreciate we said we're going to move on. One very brief thing is one of the things that helped convince me is that the guy who's in charge is Nat Friedman.
Yeah, that was interesting.
So this is, I mean, you know, Nat is a guy who came up the same way we did, right? There are a lot of high-level tech IT managers who don't really have any understanding of the whole open source world, the whole open source community. A lot of the stuff that's threaded through the concept of GitHub, although not the implementation of GitHub. But Nat Friedman does, right? No one could point to him and say, this guy does not understand what it is he's destroying if he ends up destroying it. I don't think he will. He knows what he's doing. So I'm not worried that we'd be cast aside by accident at this point, which is pretty reassuring, to be honest.
That was actually, because I think he's not a well-known person to most people. But that, to me, was a significant chunk of this news, was the fact that he knows Microsoft, he's got great open source credentials. He's just a really nice guy as well.
Yeah, he is.
So,
also, what does this tell you? Start off hacking on random little GTK applications, end up being VP of DevTools, and then running GitHub. It's the open source rags to riches story. A lot of people would go, but then you end up working at Microsoft, which is not what they want, but nonetheless.
Yeah, don't stay in school. Go and hack on Ardor or something. All right, what's next?
Next piece of news. One very brief one, which I thought was terribly amusing. You know the Kim Jong-il Trump summit, right?
Yes.
All the accredited journalists who went there got a free USB fan to plug into their computer.
What?
Honestly, they gave them out as little kind of, you know, tchotchkes to all the journalists, a USB fan. And you can imagine the whole InfoSec world go, don't plug them in.
I would like to know if there was one journalist in the corner who didn't go to the security training for whatever journalistic place they work for. And they plug the fan in and everyone else looks aghast.
I mean, I'm assuming probably nothing. But
was it North Korea who gave out these fans, or was it the US, or was it unclear?
I don't actually know. I'm picking this up just as sort of a side piece of news. I just thought it was hilarious. I mean, and I'm assuming nobody's blatant enough to go, here are a bunch of essentially USB sticks with viruses on them. Please plug them in. I just thought that whole idea would be brilliant. I don't know if anyone's actually done a teardown on one of them.
I just Matthew thought it Garrett, was, this is your calling.
Sort of remarkably blind kind of approach to things. It's like, just don't do that. Why would you do this?
Yeah.
I just thought it was hilarious.
By the way, speaking of Matthew Garrett, I was in a pub last night. My brother's in San Francisco this week.
Oh, nice.
DockerCon.
Say hello. Oh, cool.
And they were playing Doctor Strange on the screen, and I realized Benedict Cumberbatch is Matthew Garrett. Like, Matthew Garrett's got the Benedict Cumberbatch kind of vibe to him.
You think?
If you think about it, squint your eyes, smoke some weed, take a lot of acid, and you know a little bit of meth, and then you'll see it.
I can't decide whether Garrett is more pleased that he's being compared to a famous film star and actor, or whether Benedict Cumberbatch is really pleased that people think he's a really great Colonel Hacken.
Well, give it... I don't know. You can't... Yeah. Did you see that Benedict Cumberbatch, by the way, decked four people and saved somebody?
Like, yeah.
Did you hear about this?
Yeah. Someone got mugged or something and he waded in and won the fight.
What a dude.
I know. All he right. does actually seem like quite a bloke. Also, I read a thing. I'll have to look it up and link to it in the show notes. But a thing where you can make up a name which is even sort of vaguely like his name and everyone knows who you're talking about. Right? If you say, I was watching this film and in it was that guy, you know, Bandersnoop Cucumber. And everyone knows exactly who you mean. And they gave examples of sentences where by the end of it, the name they were picking was nothing like Benedict Cumberbatch at all. And you still knew exactly who they were talking about. This doesn't work if you're Robert De Niro. It's brilliant.
It's like those when people like put words and they jumble all the letters up and you still know what the words
are.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
It's exactly, but it only works for Benedict Cumberbatch.
What a name, though.
I mean, know.
Yeah, I mean, if you're his parents... And you're like, oh, our last name is Cumberbatch. Is that his real name?
Yeah, Benedict Timothy Carlton Cumberbatch.
Wow, and you didn't think it could
Benedict
get better.
Benedict Timothy Carlton?
Carlton Cumberbatch.
Cumberbatch?
To be clear, I've just looked that up. I don't actually know this stuff off the top of my head.
I think his parents are fucking trolling him, is what I think.
And this, listener, is why you tune into Bed Voltage. It's these hard-hitting stories.
More actual news, please.
Yeah. While we're on their proprietary software tip, do you want to talk about all the stuff that happened with Apple in their conference? No? Yes?
WWDC.
This is the one. I thought there were a couple interesting things. I mean, the iOS store.
What stood out for you?
Which now turns 10, which I did not realize.
Yeah, 10 years old.
Serves 500 million weekly visitors, and as of this week, has earned developers over $100 billion, which also means that Apple has collected around $40 billion at a astonishingly high margin. So,
I have a question for you guys about this. I was thinking about this yesterday. It seems like the Apple Store is constantly performing well. Like, it seems like they're getting a lot of traffic, and it seems to be growing reasonably consistently from what I understand. I wonder, is the relationship that Android users have with the App Store different to Apple users? Or do you think that everyone's the same? Do you think it's because, like, you know, you have a phone, you install the apps that you want on it, and once you've got the, I don't know if you guys are the same as me, but once I've got the core set of apps on there, the only time I ever go to the Play Store is when someone mentions something that I should check out. I don't go and cruise for apps.
I'll give my 2 pence first because Ak actually knows what he's talking about here and will go on significantly longer, I imagine. I actually think that Apple, one of their biggest mistakes in retrospect will be not only how closed they've been in regard to the App Store, but how much of a cut they've taken. I think the one thing Microsoft did well during their meteor years was that they understood as a platform, it behooved them for developers to make a ton of money around them, because it almost built a fortress around them of developers who were so ensconced in the cash they were making that they defended Microsoft at every turn. And Apple, I don't think, really understood this. And I think a lot of it is where Tim Cook comes from as a COO and a product guy, doesn't understand developers, really, I don't think, understands the world that he lives in from a non-product perspective. He obviously understands the product side ultra well. But I think it would behoove them to take less of a cut and be a little bit more open, because I don't think people feel the same way And there's certainly not as many companies making as much money. If you're not one of the few monster blockbuster iOS apps, you really don't make any money.
Yeah.
So I think as much, like, they like to tout that they've given out $100 billion in 10 years. And it's not that that's not a lot of money, but I think they're being very myopic in how they view the market with the, I think yeah. with a little less margin and a little more thought, they could have a lot more money long term.
I think maybe so. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with a policy which has brought you $40 billion, but
it is.
But yeah, I mean, but that's essentially the way Apple do things. I do think there are two. To answer Jono's original question, I think there are two fundamentally different classes of phone users. One of whom does literally cruise the store for apps the whole time. I know people who are like that. I don't think any of the three of us are. I probably am more like it than the two of you.
Wait, so they regularly just look for random new apps that
just
are not...
go and see, I wonder what there is that's cool. Yeah,
I know
a bunch of people who do that. I don't think you two do. I do occasionally, but some people do it a lot. But yes, I agree with you. An awful lot of people do not. There have been countless surveys done where people have, you know, sort of 9 apps on their phone, and that's it. And those apps never change. And these normally dovetail into a story about how people don't make money or selling mobile apps anymore, and the gold rush of 2009 and 2010 is all over, and then there was in-app payments and so on and so forth. But yeah, I think don't necessarily believe that because we don't do it, nobody does it. And
yeah.
More importantly, it doesn't necessarily matter if a small, relatively small proportion of your audience do it, because they're still the ones who drive all the app installs, right? So if you've got 1 billion users,
yeah,
but only, I don't know, 10 million of them, 1%, act like this, and they install an app a day, that's 10 million new apps a day, right? That's you don't need that many. When you've got an audience as big as iOS has or as Android has, a relatively small proportion of your audience can still drive an awful lot of that stuff because you've got a lot of people. So yes, I think simultaneously most people do not do this, just cruise around the store looking for new apps, but there are people who do it, and they do it a lot.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I just think it's interesting.
I mean, I usually download popular apps and install them very briefly just to see what toolkits they're using, what languages they're using, kind of what their technology stack looks like, just because I like to see new trends in that space.
You are such a dork. That's your hobby?
I wouldn't consider it my hobby. Is it interesting when
hobby.
I have some time?
It's your hobby, isn't it? It's okay. There's no need to be embarrassed. You're among friend.
Now that's not very kind, is it? To be honest with you, I'm exactly the opposite on the grounds that I don't install the super popular thing because it's super popular. It's just massively inverted snobbery.
I don't actually use it, to be clear. I typically then uninstall it the same day. It's just more of curiosity.
I tend to discover a thing that was the cool app 4 years ago. Hey, this is actually quite cool. And everyone's like, yeah, it was in 2014 when we all installed it.
Have you heard
whatever.
Of this app called Riddling?
I was much the same with Blur and Oasis in retrospect, so this is not a new
thing. I have to say, I'm like that with TV. I end up watching TV shows usually when they're just halfway through the last season. It's not a criteria. Like, I started watching Lost, Game of Thrones, Dexter, the same with all these things. Yeah. I won't watch Silicon Valley, though. I'm not watching that show.
Oh, funny. So,
anyway.
It is the way of things.
A little too close to home, figuratively and literally. All right, what's next?
Right, did you see this thing about the FBI asking you to reboot your routers?
I did.
Do you know what it's about?
No, but what I was surprised is how little this...
I
percolated into the mainstream media.
Yeah, I mean,
I was surprised about that as well.
I totally, I mean, obviously the FBI aren't going to tell me to reboot my router because I don't give a shit about the FBI's opinion.
Give the give the backstory for people who aren't paying attention.
What it's actually about, someone built a piece of malware called VPN filter, and it infects routers. Normally, you know, the smaller, not, you know, big industrial stuff, just stuff you have in your house, home routers, small office routers, by the companies are Linksys, Microtik, Netgear, QNAP, and TP-Link, right? And this is much like the Stuxnet thing. There's a lot of speculation it was written by a government because it's very technically sophisticated. The Phoebes believe it's the Russian government. And they have reasons. I have no opinion on this one way or the other. But what was interesting is that they now own the command and control server for it. Right, so the reason they asked everyone to reboot their routers on the May the 25th, I think it was so when everyone reconnected to it, they'd have some sense of how many people were infected. But I didn't hear about this until 2-3 weeks afterwards, and I'm surprised that I hadn't seen anyone mention it. As you say, it wasn't in the mainstream media at all.
No.
I saw one story on CNN, and that was it. I didn't see it anywhere else.
And it looks like it was doing like active man in the middle attacks and all kinds of things where people legitimately be a little concerned.
I rebooted my router.
Did you? Oh, well done. Did you reboot
Do you own one of those brands?
No, I just rebooted it and just in case. I have an Eero. So. I don't know.
So did you reboot it especially because you've been asked to by the Phoebes or just because you have to reboot your router every day anyway?
Well... No, I did it. I did it because our good government, who I trust implicitly, asked me to do so.
Fair play, right? But yeah,
I use Ubiquiti stuff, so no.
Well, there you go. Yeah, but I just thought it was interesting how this could be quite a big deal.
Yeah.
Did we hear any more off after that? Like the result of that reboot? Like, I'm assuming it's all top secret or something. I don't know.
As far as I'm aware, they haven't said, hey, after we asked you to reboot it, this many people did. Wicked. One of the things that people have said is that, really, if you want to be sure that you're clear of this, you need to do more than just restart your router. You need to reflash it.
Right.
But, you know, who's going to...
Good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly, right? Jono, I'm not going to ask Jeremy because I'll bet money his answer is yes. Jono, have you ever flashed firmware onto a router?
No, of course not.
No, neither have I. Bet Jeremy has.
You were correct in this, yes.
Well, I thought it was much.
I mean, technically, yes, but that's just when it says, hey, you need to update your firmware, and I press the button. I probably shouldn't take credit for that.
That, I think, does not count. Right, next piece of news.
I have one. Do you remember a while back we talked about open source security with the maker of the GR security kernel patches?
Yep.
We talked about this on the show. I think it was another news item. And Bruce Perens rucked up to them and basically said, hang on, what you're doing, you know, isn't good. And the
CEO... Oh, they sued him for defamation.
Yeah.
They sued him for defamation. Well, Perens won. His legal team is going to be compensated $260,000 from this. Apparently... Perens originally wanted to the compensation to be closer to, like, it was just over $500,000, and I think it was $500,000. And the judge was like, all right, come on, Bruce, that's a bit much. You can have half of that and like it. I'm paraphrasing. So I think that was a good thing. This open source security firm seems sketchy to me in what they're doing. So I'm glad that this seems like it was the right kind of outcome.
Yeah, the impression I have of them, and this is completely unfair, but they do feel a bit sketchy, don't they? I see your point there.
Right. So, yeah. Well, the response to him was, I mean, that was unusually aggressive. You know, like most people, when they hear people moaning about stuff on the internet, just tend to brush it off. So... I was actually kind of surprised that they actually went through with the lawsuit. I assumed that it was a threat and it never happened, but it did happen.
Yes.
So anyway,
and then
also
hoist by their own petard.
Also, Bruce Perens. I haven't talked about him for ages. I didn't even realize he was still around.
Well, I didn't until the first time this story came up when he was originally sued. And you're like, wow, what? I'd forgotten all about you. Nice. Well done.
What's he doing these days?
I do not.
You guys got any idea?
I do not know.
I also do not know.
For younger listeners, Bruce Perens was quite the fixture in the earlier days of open source. You know, he was a very, very common news commentator on what was going on in this kind of burgeoning revolution. Like, I saw him on TV a few times, things like that, but he really has dropped off the radar quite a bit in recent years.
Yeah. I'm honestly not sure what he's doing now. He's according to his website, he is presently CEO of Algorand, a startup business which is producing a 50 to 1,000 megahertz software-defined radio transceiver, and of Legal Engineering, a legal technical consultancy.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay.
So there you go.
He's like B-Dale from Debian. Like, he's got his rocket business with Keith Packard, that whole thing. Have you seen that?
Keith Packard hasn't got a rocket business. He works for Intel. Well, he did work like for Intel.
Keith Packard and B-Dale, Garby, both in, not like proper rockets, I mean like model rockets.
Really?
Yeah, they're both really into rocketry.
Oh.
And they put together like a little business and they sell shit that I don't know what it is. It's just like, you know, EEPROM chips filled with rocket technology. I don't know.
Well, you're not doing a very good job evangelizing for their company here, so people should go and look that up, whatever it is, and then tell us how it works.
You know, sometimes people have criticized us for not doing research.
Well, I'll tell you, when you just drop that bombshell into the middle of the conversation, be like, wow, I have no idea they do rockets. Keith Packard makes graphics drivers.
Right. Is he still at Intel?
He certainly was until recently. I don't know if he still is, but he certainly was. Yep.
I haven't seen him for ages.
Yes.
So,
right. All right, Jeremy.
Wow. Where to go from there?
That was a stream of consciousness, wasn't it?
It was. So do you remember when John Oliver covered some net neutrality and FCC-related stuff, and shortly thereafter the FCC site went down?
Yes.
And they blamed it on a distributed denial of service attack?
Yes.
Did you see that it came out that they completely fabricated that? It never happened, and they just were making it up.
Yes.
I did not.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They just went, oh, yeah, we got DDoSed, and actually they didn't. They just, it's not clear to me whether they actually took the site down so they could avoid getting any of the votes from people, or whether they just claimed that that was happening in order to discredit things. Are they now in a position where they could say, oh, yeah, we've got no idea that a million people wanted to vote against this thing because that didn't happen because they couldn't get to the website. Lol, DDoS.
Is this objective news? Or is this...
The fact that they lied about it being a DDoS is objective news. Yes.
It is?
It was a FCC email obtained via a Freedom of Information Act request. So, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's from the FCC. It's not from an external source.
Yeah. But, oh, my God.
Yeah. You can't even make that up.
Yeah. It's kind of, you know, concerning that they just literally lied about it to people. It's like,
and this is another one.
I
have not seen much coverage about it, you know, broadly outside the tech press.
No. I will be interested to see whether Last Week Tonight cover it.
Oh, I would almost guarantee it.
You would imagine so, given all the stuff they did when they won the coal lawsuit. You would.
I have to say, I love John Oliver. I've done since he was on The Daily Show, but I'm finding I can't watch Last Week Tonight anymore because it's just so, it's become so preachy. I mean, I agree with 98% of what he's saying, but it's just so preachy these days. I don't know. Is that just me? Do you guys get that as well when you watch it?
Interesting. No, I like think it.
I genuinely think it's pretty funny. I think it's a little disconcerting that I consider that one of the more well-researched news shows, and it's a comedy show.
But
yes,
but that was always the case with The Daily Show as well.
With The Daily Show as well, yeah.
You know.
By the way, did you, this was a little while back, did you see this whole thing about a day in the life of Marlon Brando?
Yes.
No.
So.
That was them.
This was another thing from
Last Week Tonight.
Last Week Tonight. Mike Pence's daughter, who is like, she, you know, she's an adult. She's not like a little kid, but she wrote a kid's book about a bunny rabbit, you know, that basically lives, I think lives at the White House or something along those lines. And it was just like instilling some, you know, the usual conservative values type stuff. Anyway.
So this is actually a rabbit that Mike Pence actually owns, and it's called Marlon Bundo. Which is a good name for a rabbit, right?
It is. It is.
So his daughter wrote a kid's book about it.
Yeah, and it's a fictional day in the life of Marlon Bundo, who's the pet rabbit of Mike Pence. Now, Mike Pence, not a fan of the gays, it turns out.
Indeed not.
So the Last Week Tonight team basically created... a book called A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo. Actually, I think, no, what wasn't the other, wasn't the Pence's rabbit is called something else, isn't it?
Oh, now I can't.
Oh, no, it is.
No, I think Pence's rabbit
is. Oh, no, it is. Marlon Bundo's A Day in the Life of the Vice President.
Yeah.
Written by Mike Pence's daughter, Charlotte Pence. Anyway, so the Last Week Tonight team created A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo, which is the story of a same-sex romance between Marlon Bundo and another rabbit named Wesley. And, you know, that the stink bug wants to stop this from happening, which is clearly, you know, Mike Pence and all the rest of it. So anyway, they basically released it on the same day that the normal book was coming out. And they gave some of the proceeds to the Treasure to the Trevor Project and AIDS United. And it just, like, massively outsold, you know, Pence's daughter's book.
Yeah.
Genius.
I mean, wonder what the budget for that show is. Because some of the things that they do on there is just...
It's pretty high. They are strong on production values and stuff like that. Yeah, it's the kind of thing where
it is good.
Wow, yeah. This must have cost you loads. Like they've done things like got out and bought 5 wax models of past presidents, each of which was sort of $7,000 or $8,000 or whatever. And that's like for a 5-minute joke. They've just gone, let's blow $60,000 on this.
Yeah,
and the whole bunch of other shows going, dude, that's our whole budget for everything, staff and everything.
Yeah,
shows you HBO. We're doing okay.
It is.
No, it's not TV. Funny. It's HBO.
All right.
Let's cover a tech story. Why don't we? What about Bitcoin? You see yet another hack in the Bitcoin space, resulting in more price declines.
No, what was this? I saw the thing about
$19,783 in late December of 2017, so roughly 6 months ago.
Yeah.
It's currently sitting at just over $6,500.
Wow. So
quite volatile.
What were our predictions for Bitcoin's value? I can't remember now. We'd have to go back and check for January.
Did we have a prediction?
I think one of us did. Did you you saw the thing about how it's using 20% of all the electricity on Earth or whatever it is now, right?
Yeah, that was one of the news stories I had listed for the last show, but we didn't have enough time.
Ah, like that was
that's ridiculous.
It was nuts. Hang on, I'm just checking the data. Yeah, so Bitcoin consumes about as much power as Ireland.
As in the country Ireland?
The country of Ireland, yes.
Jesus.
Apparently it might rise from the current 2.6 gigawatts of power, which is almost as much as Ireland. It might rise...
That'll power a DeLorean.
It will, twice. And in fact, looking at this, the article in Ars Technica has a picture of Doc Brown hanging off the clock in Back to the Future. Apparently it might rise to 7.7 gigawatts before the end of 2018, accounting for almost 0.5% of the world's electricity consumption.
That's
ridiculous.
What amazing times we live in.
Because it kind of felt to me like the bloom's gone off the rose a bit of Bitcoin. I mean, obviously the price has dropped and everything, but people aren't talking about it as much as they were. But is that just saturation now? Everyone's still doing just as much
about
as they
blockchain.
Were. Well, people talk about the blockchain. Bloody blockchain, yes.
Yeah.
But I'm not seeing as many people talk about Bitcoin anymore. So it felt like, you know, it had reached its a peak of media interest, at least, and is now on the downturn.
So what was this hack? I haven't heard about this.
There was another exchange this time. I believe it was one in South Korea.
Oh.
That interestingly had a bunch of cold wallet storage. So a CoinDesk it was. Or no, CoinDesk is what CoinRail.
Right, because they're not CoinDesk.
And $42 billion in market value was destroyed in the sell-off that was a result of that. So the fact that there's $42 billion of market value to destroy is...
Yeah.
Founding, but
I just...
Also you could buy GitHub six times.
I just don't understand this. This, to me, it's like trying to understand Klingon. The whole... I don't get it. I don't get it. Did you see, though, on a related note, that apparently Wells Fargo have put a prohibition on buying cryptocurrencies with their credit cards?
A bunch of credit cards already had this, because I know a couple people that tried to buy them and their cards got frozen.
Really?
Yeah.
As you can tell, I don't keep up with Bitcoin, but this was news to me. I just thought, apparently the reason for it is the worry, you know, lenders are worried that they'd be left on the hook if a borrower lost money on the digital on a digital currency bet and couldn't repay it. And I was thinking, that seems ironic, banks, that you don't want people to make poor financial decisions and then not be able to pay it back. Mortgage crisis.
Yes, the interesting thing about Bitcoin is there's a whole market now called local Bitcoin where you actually meet someone in a coffee shop and exchange USB keys, basically. Which
really?
Like there's a certain kind of irony there. Yeah, it's called local Bitcoin.
What's the point?
Buying
I don't
Bitcoin.
Understand.
I'll give you your Bitcoin is different to my Bitcoin.
Isn't the whole point of Bitcoin precisely that you don't have to do that?
It is, but if you have to pay cash and you can't use a card and you need
Wait. The transaction fees are now high enough that people would rather travel to a coffee shop and hand over a USB key.
I mean, that's not the predominant way that it happens, but it is a thing, yes.
Oh, man.
It is a thing that I know multiple people who have done, to be clear. It's not a theoretical thing.
This stuff is just beyond parody at this point, as far as I can tell.
It's ridiculous. That's going to be this new generation's version of what was it? Like at conferences, like when people would all meet up with their passports and exchange PGP keys and everything.
Key signing parties, yeah.
Key signing parties. Worst party I've ever been to. Not fun.
That is the thing. And now that's
key signing parties.
It's just I'm now starting to believe that. The film actually ended in 2005, and what we're living through is now one of those little blooper reel bits that you get alongside the credits. Right.
All right. What's next?
Next piece of news.
I have a little thing.
Oh, go on.
I bought a Fitbit Versa.
Okay.
Which came out quite recently, and I thought maybe I could do a mini review.
A mini review, yes.
Because Jeremy's... Well, Jeremy's always given me shit the fact that I'm reviewing old Kindles,
yes.
Right? Which is...
accurate. I think the word you're looking for is accurate, is what it is.
It could suggest that has occurred. But yeah, it's... look, no one else can see this, but check it out. It looks like an Apple Watch.
It does.
Yeah, it does.
Wow, that actually looks like a watch, not like a Fitbit.
Yeah, and it's not too bad. I mean, it doesn't...
But you wear
dramatic.
A watch.
I wear a watch... I wear a watch when I go out at night, but I don't tend to wear a watch much during the day. I track my steps and all the rest of it.
Oh, okay.
So
you've got a really nice watch. Wear it.
Well, yeah. But the watch can't tell me what my heart rate is. And this one can. So this is, it's waterproof. It does all the usual stuff that a Fitbit does. You know, it tracks your heart rate, steps. You can, you know, add different types of exercises that you're doing. You know, it's pretty good in terms of like, you know, you can see your notifications from wherever, from text, but from Google Hangouts and, you know, whatever else, phone calls, which, you know, again, other Fitbits can do, but because it's a bigger screen, you know, it's a bit nice for actually reading things like text. What was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, but the other thing is that you can upload music to it as well. So if you go for a run, you can just take this out. Although I don't believe it's got a GPS in it. So you probably take your... Well, first of all, who's going to go out without their phone? Everybody goes out with their phone generally. Well, men tend to go out with their phones. It's harder for women who don't necessarily have pockets and don't want to carry a purse around. So I think there's that element of it. And it's really good. The only criticism I would say is if people have got a Fitbit Charge 2, it's not massively different. It's just more of a like a it's a Fitbit Charge 2 with a cool screen. Is the way I would describe it.
Basically all the Fitbits just been, you know, minor iterations on the previous one for years now?
Not really. I mean, they've kind of got two lines. They've got like the ones with like, you know, a small screen. So those have iterated, you know, a little bit over the years, you know. But then they brought out one called the Ioniq, which is more of it's an ugly smartwatch.
Okay.
And then they brought out this one, which is a better looking smartwatch. But I think it's nice. You know, the one thing that I had a criticism of a while back on Bad Voltage about Fitbit was that their quality assurance was dog shit. Like I went through a number of them that broke. It does seem like they've got that in action. And I think the overall consumer experience of Fitbit is pretty good. Like if you've got the scale and then you've got the watch and all the rest of it, it all glues together quite nicely. So yeah, the main reason why I got this was because I wanted to take it swimming, which I shouldn't do with the Fitbit Charge 2. But yeah, so if you're looking for a health band smartwatch type thing and you don't want to get sucked into the miserable world of actual smartwatches, because I don't want all of that crap on my wrist. I only want health stuff on my wrist. I think I'm actually going to disable the notifications.
I will say, I still do like smartwatches. I seem to be in the... I mean, I don't wear one all the time. I don't have one on now. And I have a dedicated running watch that is, you know, a Garmin and is pretty high quality. But while it has some smartwatch functionality, I only use it as a running watch. Or it does triathlon stuff too, so you can swim with it, all that as well. 645M, if you're really looking for a high quality running watch, it's been the nicest running watch probably I've had so far.
Nice. Are you still using your Moto, whatever it was, as your smartwatch?
Yeah. The Moto 362.
You still like it?
Yeah. No, I think for the minimal functionality that I use it for, I don't really use it for the notifications and other stuff, but I think some of the data that you get out of it, and it also looks like a decent watch, I like that confluence.
It does.
So I hear that there might be a Pixel watch coming out soon. I'm interested to see what that will be, and maybe I'll make a switch then. But no, I've had that for a few years now, and it still runs the latest version of Wear OS, and it's still in pretty good shape. So,
yeah, I assumed that Google were going to be killing off their smartwatch stuff, but it turns out they just rebranded it, and it looks like they're investing more in it. So I don't know. All right. We're 52 minutes in, fellas. Yeah,
One of the things I wanted to talk about was last weekend I was at Foss Talk Live, which is the third year of this little open source podcast event down in London. I was there flying the flag for Bad Voltage since you two slackers didn't show up. being as you are on a different continent and all, so you are excused, but nonetheless. This thing, it's basically got live shows from various different podcasts. So the Ubuntu podcast chaps were there, Late Night Linux, Linux Voice Reformed, and then what we lovingly call the Drunken Mashup Show at the end, which is me, Dave, Joe Essington, and Marius Quarterback. And it was just really good fun, right? Now, Joe Essington is the one who runs it, and he puts in quite a lot of work to get the thing to happen. He basically does it all himself. Now because he's into the third year of it, he's kind of got it down pat, knows what he's doing. So it's just really smooth, really efficient. But the thing I wanted to talk about was that it's really fun, and there's a lot of stuff which isn't as much fun as that anymore. An awful lot. Yeah. I mean, you've got sort of meetups. If you live in a city, especially like I do, there'll be lots and lots of tech meetups you can go along to, which will have 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 people. I mean, San Francisco, really big cities like San Francisco and London and so on are a bit different, where you go to London Web Standards and there's 98 people there or something. But
yeah.
But for a lot of cities, you know, you can find a tech meetup once a month or whatever on any topic you want. If you're a Go programmer or you want to do stuff with R or whatever, there'll be a group of 6 or 7 people who get together in a coffee shop once a month and do that. And then on a large scale, you've got conferences. So you've got things like All Things Open or Scale or whatever, which are a gargantuan mountain of work, and you've got to pay for tickets, and they've got six different speaker tracks and all this kind of thing. And I like the idea of something which is kind of in the middle. So it doesn't cost a lot of money. It doesn't have to be impeccably brilliantly organized with keynote speakers being flown in from other countries and all this kind of thing. But equally, it's a bit more put together than just say, oh, we'll just get together in this pub on the third Thursday of every month. And I really like the community feel of it. One of the things that we've talked about in the show in the past is what the nature of success is for open source and Linux and so on. And given that my views change from, well, we want to be on every computer in the world, to, I don't really care. It does everything that I want to do. And we're now at a point of sustainability, so I don't think it's going to go away. I'm not that worried about evangelism anymore. I'm more than happy to just hang out with people who believe as I do, without feeling the need to say, okay, this conference has got 100 people. Next year, it would be really good if it had 300 people. We must really push the marketing word out to get more people to come and more people to see the truth and all. Just whatever, man. I'm cool with just going along and hanging out with people who I already like. And this seemed like a really good example of that to me. And I wondered what you guys thought about that. I mean, maybe there are lots and lots and lots of these things, and I'm just not seeing them, or they're too far away, or whatever. But it feels like we could do with a bit of a revitalization of that friendly community feeling without the need for either evangelism or enterprise rollouts or big pushes. You know, we go back to how we were in 2008 or 2009, when it was a bit more fun and a bit less, how do I get my next round of funding?
Sounds like we need another Bad Voltage Live.
Oh, well, I mean, Lug Radio Live was created in order to foster that kind of mindset. Right? I mean, I don't want to do Bad Voltage Live, a conference, but us doing the live show at conferences kind of fits into this mindset in my head, you know?
Maybe it's time to practice what you preach. I agree with everything you just said. Maybe there could be a Bad Voltage Live in Birmingham each year.
No, but then it's just...
And maybe Joe could help run it.
Well, we can't do a Bad Voltage Live because...
I'll call it something else.
It can't be Bad Voltage Live because you two won't be on it. Or if you two are on it, then suddenly it stops being fun and starts being a thing with a bill of at least £4,000. So, but yeah, I mean, I did actually say to Dave on the way out of the pub, right, we need like Foss Talk Live Birmingham. This was fun. I want this to be more than once a year. Why don't we do this? But
I think it's one of those... Yeah, I think you're right, though, because I remember... When we did Lug Radio Live, the major goal of that wasn't really around the show, and it wasn't really around... We didn't want to set up... You know, at the time, the major event in the UK was the Linux Expo, and we didn't want to set that up. We didn't want, a formal exhibitors and all that kind of... The kind of stuff that Alan needs to run through with Scale and with the Datadog events. We want this to be a place where people can come and have fun and hang out. And you've got to have content to make it interesting. So you had some talks, but it was more about the social element.
Yeah.
And I remember we went into so much depth about things like one thing that was important to me is that when the doors opened, AC/DC was playing because it was like a fun kind of like party kind of atmosphere. And I don't think there are, I mean, this is going to sound massively egotistical, but I haven't seen any other event like that. I've seen events that have similar things to that. And I think Foss Talk Live, from what I can tell, is similar in spirit. It's not the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the very first LRL was. It's small. I mean, there was only probably 80 or 90 people there. But the point is, that's fine. That's the kind of size you want, because it's the kind of event that a person can put on. I mean, Ilan does a fantastic job with Scale. It's a brilliant conference. But it's his life. For months, setting this up ahead of time.
But I also,
you know,
the other thing here is that most, like, I think it's easier to do this in the UK because there is a much smaller community in the UK and it's a smaller country. So you could run an event like that. Like, I haven't seen hardly any event like that. I have seen a couple of similar types of, like, PenguinCon, for example, which is in Michigan. Is a similar kind of vibe.
Although I suppose that's a good point. I could just go down to London and that was 2 hours on the train and then I was there, where someone runs something in Detroit and you go, that sounds great, but that's a 5-hour plane journey away.
Right. And
that's not me going, like, I'll drop in on this conference in, I don't know, Rome or something. Yeah.
But it would be fun to have, like, an event that is just, like, for open source people, that's just fun. Like, it's just...
Yeah, this is my thing. You don't have to say, well, you know, we need to make sure that when someone pitches a talk, that it's not a product pitch, because no one would even think to do that, you know?
Right.
Something where you're doing it for the joy of it, and that's the only motive. I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm massively over-romanticising things, and it's just that... I really enjoyed my Saturday, and I'd like to enjoy other Saturdays the same way.
Turns out Stuart likes sitting in a pub talking about tech.
Well, would you believe
it? The mind reels.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. So, and I'd like to actually hear from our listeners if you know of events that are kind of like that.
Yeah.
Particularly in the US.
You know where they should let us go you know where they should go to let us know this?
Is it the Bad Voltage Forum or Slack channel or whatever that thing is?
Community.badvoltage.org.
Yes. Go to community.badvoltage.org and let us know.
No, but I'd be interested too, especially by region, just so, you know, Jono might be able to go to one by him, or if there's one, you know, near New York State, I'd certainly check it out.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be fun. It'd be fun.
Yeah.
I think we should probably think about wrapping it up, because... it's been quite long, and I'm hungry.
Cool. Are you chaps speaking anywhere before the next show? I would have mentioned Fostall Live in the last show, but we didn't do the last show. So.
Not before the next show for me. You, Jono?
No, not before the next show. Cool. Got some stuff. OSCON's coming up soon, but that's next month. So.
Excellent. Then we're good.
All right. Well, people of the internet, thank you for listening to our ramblings. Go to the forum, join the Slack channel, go to the other, whatever that thing was. What is it? What's it called? Matrix? Was that what it was called?
It's called Matrix, yes. You can now connect to our Slack channel on Matrix if you want to.
Okay, brilliant. Take the blue pill. All right. Bye.